Doogie.
Sam.
Liverpool broke records during this summer in an attempt to build an all-star team set for long-term dominance. But the early performances have been seriously underwhelming. What is going on at Anfield? What has happened to the Reds?
In the last week, losses to Crystal Palace, Galatasaray and, of course, Chelsea as well.
They're really poor defensively. They really are poor defensively. They're yet to find a balance. And Van Dijk and Konate, they're looking very, very shaky. They've got no protection whatsoever.
Mostly the football issues right now are combining to create this sort of fog, basically, and a team that just doesn't look right.
I don't want to say that Liverpool are in crisis, because I don't think they are. And I think the problems that they have are solvable. But at the moment, right across the pitch, there are problems.
This is certainly a mini crisis because of the way that they're playing. They haven't been at it all season.
Yes, hello everybody. Welcome to another episode of The Truth, your Friday companion. Episode 6 of the season, Doogie. In the midst of another international break, it's the perfect time to take stock of one of the biggest budding Premier League storylines. But first, how are you?
I'm good, thanks, Sam. I'm good, thanks. Yeah, I had a little bit of a drop back down to reality after a heady start for Sunderland at the weekend. Although I was saying to Jack before we started recording, I was surprised to be so disappointed that Sunderland lost at Old Trafford. But we did lose pretty comfortably. Robin Roos did his best, but we didn't really show up as we had in our previous games. But yeah, back down to reality. But what I realise I haven't asked you, which we used to do during the intros of all our podcasts last year, what's going on with the Detroit Lions?
Oh!
Yeah.
Wow, what a welcome surprise. It genuinely wasn't planned. Both of the teams that I support are on four-game win streaks, Doogie. Aston Villa and the Detroit Lions. A lovely symmetry.
I know far, 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 far less about the Detroit Lions. What's kind of the story of their season so far?
We lost on the opening weekend to Green Bay and it looked like we might be awful, but now we're absolutely decimating teams. Absolutely decimating teams.
Trending
and it looks
direction.
And it looks like we might be quite good. Look, early season in the NFL, the adage goes, you don't want to play your best football in October, you want to play your best football in January. So for the top teams, it's about just putting wins on the board however possible. And you can see that across the league. The Lions are doing it, the Eagles are doing it. The Chiefs aren't doing it,
yeah,
which is really
even
strange.
I know that.
And the Ravens have completely fallen apart due to injuries. So no determinations yet, no conclusions being drawn, but for now, very happy.
Well, since we fixed Aston Villa on that podcast a couple of weeks ago, real turnaround there as well.
I know, not bad, huh? Four wins in a row. People keep trying to tell me it's two because it's two Premier League wins, but it's four. You can't take the European wins away from us. Beating final was good as well.
Yeah.
In the end, it was a good performance. So yeah, not bad at all. Who should we fix next?
Well, I mean, Liverpool is the topic of the day. I don't know whether fixing is quite the right word, but they're definitely having some teething problems, aren't they, Sam?
They definitely are, yeah. Before we go any further, let me just introduce the Overlord, the podcast Overlord.
He loves it.
I love it.
Yeah. It's a wry grin there. Jack, hello, my friend.
Yeah, hello, Sam. How are you?
Very well. I have a question for you.
Is it the New York Jets are not playing their best football in October? Because I can tell you they're not.
So the Jets are 0-5.
0-5, the only team.
The only team in the league that have yet to win a game.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, funnily enough, my question is, what's worse, watching Fulham or watching Ireland? But I guess I can... What's worse, watching Fulham, watching Ireland or watching the Jets?
I think the answer is still Ireland. Like, I don't have any expectation when it comes to the Jets. Like, this is what the Jets do.
Yeah.
So that's like slightly different. Fulham are okay. It's just that we seem to have a real capitulation in us at the moment. But with Ireland, it's just constantly god awful. So fingers crossed. So big test for my marriage coming up.
Ooh,
first
yeah.
big test.
Yeah.
Ireland play Portugal on Saturday.
Oh, yeah.
Massive.
Yeah.
That could be interesting.
Oh, you... Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, not great, Sam. Not great.
Okay. Okay, fine. But is it at least a good time for an international break for Fulham?
It's a good time for an international break for Fulham. The problem is that when it gets to an international break, I have to watch Ireland.
Yeah.
So, like, there's never a good time for an international break for me.
For
in many ways.
Jack, yeah.
Alas, we are where we are. Perhaps this time it will be different, which is something that they say about the Jets.
For sure. Doogie, same question, really. Is it a good time for an international break for Sunderland?
Yes, but then I look with massive trepidation about our fixtures after the international break. We've got Wolves at home, which is pretty lovely to get back into it. Yeah. Then we play six of our next eight games are against sides currently in the top eight. And then it's the derby versus Newcastle. And then we've got a hellish rest of December as well. So this is like Sunderland's really bleak time in terms of fixtures. And then AFCON comes in January. So strap yourselves in, guys. We've enjoyed the ride so far at the top, or near the top, let's say. But we could be heading down towards the lower mid-table in the next few weeks, I would have thought.
Maybe. All depends on how you react to that loss, because you put together a nice run of form, and it's kind of, you know, once you get momentum in this league, it's quite easy to feel good about yourselves. And you know, there's always that, those cliches about there's a good zip in training and all that. It's all true, though. Mm. Particularly when you have someone like Granit Xhaka in the building. A lot of the players recently have been talking about how important he's been. But in this league, it's all about how you react to losses. And there probably was a bit of expectation going into the Old Trafford game, wasn't there? I certainly thought that you might be able to pull something off based on the form. Didn't happen. Let's see what happens next. I'm in two minds about Villa on the international front. On the one hand, if you win four in a row, clearly you have momentum and you don't really want that to be broken up. But on the other hand, managing a few injuries already and absences, like Jadon Sancho's been ill for a week and a half. No one knows where he is. Onana's been injured. Tielemans has been injured. Mings is injured. So it'd be nice to get some players back and fit. And also, it's really important for someone like Harvey Elliott to get 2 weeks on the training pitch with Unai Emery, because he needs to adapt to the style of play, and there's a lot for him to learn. So the quicker we can get Elliott into the team, the better it will be for everyone. But that doesn't happen unless he's got the reps in with Emery. So an international break is really good for someone like Harvey.
Absolutely. And we will shortly get on to Liverpool. But in the WhatsApp group this week, you've been talking about one man and one man only, and that's Bogard.
Lamar Bogard.
Do you want to give him a little shout out on the pod?
Well, since Jack threatened to cancel the entire podcast when I pitched the idea that Lamar Bogard is the new Rodri and it would be this week's episode, I guess maybe I can give him 30 seconds.
Yeah, go on.
Look, he's clearly not the next Rodri, but it's displeasing that, like, with Villa having such problems recently in the transfer market and with the budgets and, you know, freeing up all the money and SCR and PSR and everything and everyone and all the player swaps, that a player can just kind of come through from the academy, albeit stolen from Feyenoord at 17, and just emerge into a really handy player. Like, that's just perfect for a club like Villa at the moment. And the really amusing thing about Bogard at the moment, which is something I'm quite into, is that he has effectively taken on the traits of lots of other Aston Villa players, which is really cool to see. Like, it's a testament to development and growth. It's a testament to surrounding, and it's a testament to coaching, which I think a lot of managers just can't be bothered with anymore. Like, not to just call him out immediately, but like when Levi Colwill went down, Enzo Maresca wanted another signing. And I'm like, you just signed Joel Hatto and you have about six other centre-backs. Have you tried maybe coaching any of them to make them better? That would be in your remit, wouldn't it? And so for Emery to bring Bogard along very steadily, he's probably at about 1,000 minutes now. He's nicked the way Konsa wins fouls. He's stolen that. He's stolen the way McGinn protects the ball. And he has taken a lot of positional traits from Boubacar Kamara. And Bogard's ability to play centre-back, centre-mid and right-back is already really obvious. And at the weekend, he played all three at the same time, just in the same way that Boubacar Kamara does. I just found it really fun to watch. Like, it's like a little mini-me, you know? Like a mini-camera. Nowhere near as good, obviously. But good to see. It's cool.
I'm glad to hear it. Yeah. I'm glad to hear it. But we might as well get into the big topic of today's podcast, which is Liverpool. In terms of why we're talking about it, it's fairly obvious. They won their first eight games of the season, but they've lost their last three, all in the space of 7 days. There was that 2-1 defeat away at Crystal Palace, a 1-0 defeat away at Galatasaray, and a 2-1 defeat away at Chelsea. The winning goal at Palace was scored in the 97th minute by former Arsenal striker Eddie Nketiah. The winning goal at Chelsea was conceded in the 95th minute. And there's nothing like conceding a last-minute goal to really dampen the mood around a club and to make people kind of panic. And we've seen a fair amount of that on social media in the last few days, despite the fact that Liverpool are now just 1 point behind Arsenal at this early stage. The Champions League table, it's so early to even take too much from it. But, you know, there's so much time to recover there as well. But for the first time in his Liverpool career, Arne Slot is under a little bit of pressure, especially given the fact that in the summer they spent the biggest outlay ever recorded in English football history. So there will be questions asked about it, Sam.
Yeah, just a couple of stats to throw in here as well. Liverpool have just lost three games in a row for the first time since 2023, which doesn't sound that long ago, but at the same time, clubs like Liverpool don't tend to lose three games in a row. So it's quite a hefty time span. And it's also three losses in a row for Arne Slot. And I believe it's the first time in his career that he has lost three games in a row. So, interesting. It's just like we talked, mentioned earlier with Sunderland, like how do you respond to the loss at Old Trafford and the loss of momentum, and how does that change the dynamic? Well, you know, for Liverpool and especially for Slot, this is pretty much uncharted territory over the last couple of years. And for him in his entire career, he's never faced rebounding from three losses. I don't want to make it too dramatic and too big a thing because losses happen, but like it's new territory. It's going to be interesting to see. And probably what hasn't helped him here is there was a really catchy headline this week. Did you see?
I don't know.
Where he was talking about how when he came in, he had benefited from Jurgen Klopp's tenure and that was no longer happening. Now, the actual quotes and what he was actually talking about was very, very reasonable. He was talking about, first of all, Klopp had coached a hell of a group of players, so he benefited from that immediately. He was also talking about how he perhaps benefited from the fact that Liverpool's finishes in the last seasons before that, they dropped off, right? And people had underestimated Liverpool. They thought, oh, the post-Klopp era is going to be really tough. Who's this guy? First Premier League game. They're not going to be as good. And he thinks he preyed on that and was able to take advantage of people not taking Liverpool seriously enough. And now that is not the case. Reigning champions, had the league wrapped up by March. You can't second guess this team. And he's not benefiting from that anymore. That's all completely reasonable, isn't it? But of course, the headline is Slot no longer benefiting from Klopp. You can see how it gets written and twisted. And I just thought, tough timing on that.
Yeah, it's quite an admission, isn't it? And, you know, it is completely right. I mean, Liverpool finished third the season prior to him taking over. They were 9 points behind City. They were seven behind Arsenal. They'd actually been top at the start of April that year, that final year under Klopp. But they only won four of their final nine games. They lost to Palace and Everton. They drew with United, West Ham and Villa. In comes Arne Slot, and he wasn't the favourite as well, which I think is worth noting. They wanted Xabi Alonso. He decided to stay at Bayer Leverkusen another season. Mm. And eventually Arne Slot comes in, and a lot of people that don't take much interest in European football went sort of, Arne who? Who is this guy? Is he good enough for the league? And it also worth bearing in mind that Klopp is an absolute icon of Liverpool. He took them from a fairly mediocre side and had a challenging first year or so, although the style of play was definitely getting rapidly better. But he finished in the top four in seven of his eight seasons, despite not having anywhere near the spending power as lots of the rivals. Won a Premier League, an FA Cup, two League Cups, reached two Champions League finals, also won a Champions League final, so reached three Champions League finals as well. And at the time of his departure, only Kenny Dalglish had a better win percentage of all Liverpool managers. He was also one of the biggest personalities that English football has ever seen. Slot arrives, and that summer doesn't go to plan at all. They don't sign Zubimendi. They only sign Chiesa and Mamardashvili. Mamardashvili stays another year at Valencia. Chiesa was very much a bit part player last year. He missed 14 games with injury. He only played 104 league minutes all season.
He was a punt, wasn't he, really? It was an end-of-window punt. Now, we've got a bit of spare cash. Didn't buy Zubimendi. Why don't we have a look at Chiesa? You never know what he might get back to. And I supported the idea. It was a small fee. Wages aren't super cheap, but it was worth a punt. Remember what Chiesa was at the Euros?
Well, exactly. And he looked very much sort of a player quite low on confidence, but they also had so many forward options last year, which we'll come on to during the course of this podcast. But actually, he's played significantly better this season than he did last season, in my opinion. But Liverpool had a phenomenal year last year. One defeat in their opening 30 games against Nottingham Forest at home. They racked up a 12-point lead, and Slot was breaking all sorts of records. He was the first Premier League manager to win their first six away games, quite an achievement, the quickest manager to reach 15 wins in all competitions, and the first Liverpool manager to win 11 of their first 12 matches at the start of the season. Their results in the cup competitions didn't quite go their way. They obviously lost in the Carabao Cup final against Newcastle. They were knocked out of the FA Cup by Plymouth, knocked out of Europe by eventual winners PSG. But in terms of his biggest achievements of the season, it was clearly getting the best season out of Mo Salah's career, and there have been numerous top seasons to choose from. The reinvention of Ryan Gravenberch, who'd only started 12 league games the previous season, turned into an elite number six, started 37 league games. He also got the best out of Luis Diaz on the left-hand side, got the best out of Cody Gakpo on the left-hand side. And there were numerous other success stories as well.
I think him just finding solutions as well, like deploying Luis Diaz as a striker for about a 10-game stretch because they didn't really have anyone up front that they could trust. And it just worked, you know, dovetailing with Salah and using basically a false nine just dipping in and out of that tactic. It's not easy to do.
Absolutely.
He managed to do it.
And a lot of Liverpool fans that I've spoken to in the last few days say that that was probably Van Dijk's best ever season as well. The midfield of Gravenberch, McAllister and Szoboszlai that hadn't really worked together that effectively in the final Klopp year became this absolute force, this tour de force in slots first. And yeah, they won the league at a counter despite a late sort of, you know, as it happens often with these runaway leaders, kind of a late losing of momentum, let's say.
Yeah.
But Sam, going into this summer, I don't think anyone quite expected what happened on the transfer front.
No, not at all. Look, they were going to, I guess they sensed an opportunity here with Man City still in flux. And maybe they were just looking to stay ahead of Arsenal because Arsenal clearly is starting to rear its head as a serious challenger. Went very close 2 years in a row and not going away, right? Built a very sustainable platform of a team with some really, really good players. Only getting stronger, you have to spend to keep up. And so Liverpool did it. I am going to leave this section to you, though, because I know that your favourite thing in life is to start just listing off transfer business. So I will leave this to you because it's a hell of a list. But start with who went out.
Okay, who went out? I mean, they sold Darwin Nunez, Luis Diaz went to Bayern Munich, more on him later, Joao Kwanzaa, who barely featured last season after getting substituted at halftime, I think, of their opening game against Ipswich.
1,300 minutes in the league. It's not horrendous, but I agree. He came off halftime in Ipswich and then wasn't seen again for like 3 months in the
league. It did take quite a while. Yeah. Ben Gannon-Doak went to Bournemouth.
This is my favourite development.
The change of name.
Yeah. This is brilliant.
Jamie Bynoe-Gittens-esque.
Yes, but only because Gannon is just like obviously the big villain in the Zelda games.
Oh, so I didn't know this.
Gannon has a real cultural element for me, and Ben Gannon-Doak just makes him sound like a dark demonic force that's coming to get you, which is it's pretty apt for a very skillful winger.
Absolutely, he looks like he's got a big future ahead of him. Kelleher obviously went to Brentford to replace Flecken, who went over to the Bundesliga. Trent left. More on him later. Tyler Morton also left. Mm-hmm.
Harvey Elliott left.
Harvey Elliott left on loan, of course. I was just thinking of permanent ones, but yeah, well pointed out. So they did spend £415 million, but their net spend was £228 million, which was actually £20 million less than Arsenal's, who are not good sellers of players.
Before we go into the incomings here, just to point out as well that obviously unexpected, Diogo Jota passed away, which created, I mean, a very, very difficult atmosphere for the club to work in during the summer anyway. And enough about like the drama of all the incomings and the sagas, like adding Jota's untimely passing to the mix made it all the more difficult. And the squad building exercise took on a very different shade, which was very regrettable. But I'm just going to, I added up all the minutes that these players that you've just mentioned played and then added Jota to it too. Last season, 14,469 minutes in all competitions for Trent, Kelleher, Kwanzaa, Diaz, Morton, Darwin, Gannon-Doak, Elliott and Jota. And then, because they've tried to replace Robertson with Kerkez, Robertson played 3,321. So it's 14,500 minutes without Robertson, 17,790 minutes played with Robertson. All those, that's a lot of minutes. And they've just been taken out of the team, which I think goes some way to explaining how much of a rebuild or a revolution this squad has actually undergone. It does a nice job of painting just how different. When you take that many minutes out of a team like that, it's incredible in terms of a shift.
Well, exactly. I mean, their six most used players from last season were Salah, Van Dijk, Gravenberch, McAllister, Konate and Alisson. Mm. They're all still at the club. You imagine they'll be, well, maybe not Konate given his current form, but they'll be stalwarts of this campaign as well. But you're right. Szoboszlai was ranked seventh. He's now been moved position to play a lot of his games as a right back. Robertson was eighth. Luis Diaz, ninth. He left for Bayern Munich. 10th was Trent. 13th, Diogo Jota. Sadly, devastatingly, no longer with us. 14th, Nunez. 15th, Keller. 16th, Tsimikas. So what I'm saying is that although the core remains, the kind of supporting act around which the core thrived last season has basically all changed this year. And it's led to a huge sort of uncertainty in every facet of their game. But there'll be a lot of people saying, oh, why are you playing the violin for Liverpool? Because they spent £415 million.
They did spend a lot of money on the following players.
Yes.
Jeremy Frimpong, 30 mil. Milos Kerkez, 40 mil. Giovanni Leone, 26 mil. Ekitike, 69 million and rising. Florian Wirtz, 100 million plus a potential 16 million. Would have been a potential British record. Forget that conversation, because Isak cost, in the end, 125 million, which is an outright British record. This is a lot of money. And it is on, you know, Frimpong, Kerkez, Ekitike, Wirtz, Isak. Five intended starters, key starters, with Leone as a backup. And add in the fact that Isak took 3 months. They stole Ekitike off Newcastle. They had Mark Gay in a kit in a photo shoot, and then it fell through. It was dramatic.
I never knew he was in a photo shoot. That's
I think
hilarious.
He'd done all of his media duties.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, gosh, that is
a
savage.
Full on João Polinha in Munich.
Yeah. In terms of how they could afford it, because a lot of people were sort of questioning this in the summer, across 2020-21 to 24-25, so the last five previous seasons prior to this summer, Liverpool's net spend was £252 million. That was only eighth in the Premier League. In that time, Chelsea's was over 700, Man United's around 550, Arsenal's was 468. Liverpool's was only £32 million more than Forest in that time period, and it was £200 million less than Spurs's. So they hadn't actually spent that much money in the previous 5 years, despite the fact, and then gone on, I should say, to win a Premier League title, an FA Cup, two League Cups, and reach a Champions League final. So they'd had a lot of revenue coming into the side. The side had really thrived, and they'd kind of built success off a number of players and a number of transfers that really hit the jackpot for a long, long time.
Yeah, I mean, when you sign Salah and he just hits it off and then just does it again, and again, and again, and again. And you sign Alisson, and he's just perfect, apart from the injuries, again and again and again. And Virgil van Dijk works out to the degree it does, and you pluck one of the best passers the world has ever seen from your academy and play him at right back. And Robertson costs like £7 million from Hull and has stuck around for 10 years. I mean, when your hit rate is that good, you don't end up having to enter the market too often, because you retain your key players and they do the business for you. They've only really had to start acting post Mane and Firmino, and once Henderson and Fabinho had started to phase out. But those players were fixtures in the team for 6 or 7 years at a time. Maybe not Fabinho quite that long, but a very important player. So they had the liberty of not having to buy too many players for quite a long time, which is great. But then, of course, add that to the fact that they're able to sell Jarrell Kwanzaa for so much money and Tyler Morton for a decent wedge and Kelleher and even Elliot, really, because they paid a tribunal fee of, Jack, 6 million, something like that, from Fulham in the end.
Yeah, they paid a tribunal fee of not enough.
Not enough money. And, you know, they've gone and they've shipped him off to Villa now for 35 or 40 million or so. So, hey, the numbers work if you can play the game. Liverpool play the game better than just about anybody. But look, they did surgery on the squad this summer.
Massive.
Surgery on a title-winning squad. It's rare. They obviously sensed an opportunity to go out and get five or six players that they thought would be pieces, would be their next Alissons, their next Van Dijks, their next Salahs, and fair play. But in the interim, Arne Slot has ended up with a very different-looking team, a lot of different things to put together, a very jumbled jigsaw, really. And he looks like a man who's really struggling to put it all together and make it work, right? So there have been a lot of problems in this team. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to run us through the 11. I want to go through, like, literally the team, and we're going to point out all the problems.
Go for it.
Because, especially for non-Liverpool fans, it's probably quite a valuable exercise, because they wouldn't necessarily have realised that all of these things are afflicting the team at the same time. But it also does a really nice job of pointing out just how many problems there have been in the space of 2 months. So not all the players will have issues. And that goes for the goalkeeper, Alisson, who has been great, except that he is once again injured, which is very frustrating. But Alisson has had a fantastic start to the season, no doubt about it. The problems start at the next position, which is right back. They've used three, which is never a good sign, right?
No, absolutely not. I mean, this was the kind of signing that I think most people questioned in the summer in Jeremy Frimpong. If you're not going to change your system, because Jeremy Frimpong is a phenomenal right wing back. That is where he thrived for Bayer Leverkusen. He probably, along with Denzel Dumfries and potentially Hakimi, you could play Hakimi anywhere, really, and he'd be absolutely magnificent. But he was probably the outstanding right wing back in the world over the last couple of seasons. But he's not necessarily a right back, and he's barely been used so far this season. And look, Conor Bradley is a brilliant player, still learning his trade, but has had, you know, top moments, particularly last year as well. And then Szoboszlai, because of the introduction of Wirtz as a 10, has been used often at right back and actually has done a pretty good job there. But there has, without doubt, not been very much consistency in that position.
There's been no consistency at all. Look, Frimpong did sustain a hamstring injury, which has definitely hurt his ability to settle into the team. And that's the last thing he needed, considering he was converting positions, basically. We all pointed it out in the summer. He hasn't played right back, as in right back, for several years, probably since... maybe at the very start of the Leverkusen career. But he's, you know, I always say this about players. If they've changed positions and blossomed, it's for a reason, right? It's not, they won't be the same player if you move them back to where they were necessarily. So there was always going to be some adjustment there. I think Conor Bradley's had a really tough start to the season, but he's had a bit of a wipeout 2025 with injuries anyway. So it was always a bit much to ask him to really hit the ground running, especially in the shadow of Trent. Szoboszlai has been by far the best right back at Liverpool this season. He's been incredibly, surprisingly good at things like tracking men to the back post, cutting out passes into the winger across on the switch. A lot of like the fundamental fullback things that there's just no way he does in training or on a daily basis that he's just got. I can't believe how good he's been. I genuinely can't believe it. And it's been a bit of a saving grace because if it wasn't him, they would have been in even more trouble. Now, on the left side, Milos Kerkez has had a really bad start. But I feel a bit sorry for him because I think he's been badly misprofiled. He's been asked to tuck in as the temporary back three and build up half the time and become the left centre back, which is what Robertson did last season, and play possession football, which he can't do. Like, we've all seen Kerkez run up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down over and over again, right? He's energy, he's stamina, he's aggression, he's getting into the box and he's crossing. He is not a build-up guy. And he was initially played as that player, which I just thought was very odd. I don't know why you would do that to him.
Yeah, he's also had some pretty challenging individual games as well. I think he was pretty good in the Community Shield against Crystal Palace, at least in the first half. But I remember that game against Burnley, he gets booked for diving and then he makes a pretty cynical foul on the halfway line, nearly gets sent off, and Slot just goes, nah, we've got to get this guy off.
He's taken him off multiple times for that.
Yeah, and then Andy Robertson comes on, and Andy Robertson last year was quite sort of almost quite timid in the way he played compared to his usual sort of rampaging best. But Andy Robertson was amazing against Burnley in that sort of cameo. And I thought, oh, Robertson's just going to start from now on. For the next few games, let Kerkez really sort of ease into this. But he's been back into the starting 11. And if I was on a slot, I think there's a few areas that you could instantly improve. But I think giving Andy Robertson a run of games is probably one of them.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough on Kerkez. I don't hold him fully responsible here. Like, I'm not his biggest fan. And Jack can back me up on that. I've been a bit of a doubter at times. But I am not willing to put this all at his door. No, that's not fair.
No, I also think that there is an element of this way which is slightly different in that he has had some really bad games, and there have been some games where he's looked very, very out of his depth. There have also been some pretty solid games, and actually there's been a couple of performances that I'm like, oh, okay, that's working out quite nicely there. So I agree with you that Kerkez hasn't had the easiest start, but I think rather than being like, hey, it's been dreadful, it's been very, very up and down, because there have been some really, really good performances in amongst some of the bad bits. They often don't get highlighted quite as much, I think, as the ones, especially when you spend, you know, this kind of fee on a player. Yeah, there's always gonna be an expectation, that's fine, but it hasn't been as kind of like consistently bad as perhaps some people are making out, is probably what I would add.
That's fair. Probably because the depths have been very bad. Like, when you get taken off on a yellow in like 57th minute or something, that's like, it just looks horrendous, and it's just like, there's no way to dress it up. So
there's been a little bit of chat about this, about Belaba, right, at the start of this season as well. Been hooked a couple of times after silly fouls and making another one, and you know, people are like, oh, you know, they were charging 100 million, now it'll be worth 30. I was like, no, that's just not how this works. It's just a young player kind of working it out a little bit. It will be fine. So like, I think Kerkez will get there as well.
Yeah.
This is just a little bit, you know, he's probably slightly more exposed and asked to do a little bit more defensive work than he was at Bournemouth in terms of being asked to fly forward. I think this is a natural process of acclimatizing in many ways. I don't have any huge long-term worries about Kerkez.
No, but when you add it to all of the other issues, it's just kind of compounded it all for Liverpool. We'll keep moving through the team, go to the centre backs. Virgil's been fine. Took a lot of flack for the Caicedo goal at the weekend. Not totally convinced.
It's just because he got in a funny position and people like to make memes.
Yeah, sure. I mean, Van Dijk has never in his life closed that runner down. like if we've all been watching Virgil for his for the last 7 years, right? He never, ever, ever jumps out of the line and closes down Caicedo. And I fundamentally believe that he thinks that if he gives the goalkeeper a clear sight on that shot, 98 times out of 100, he will save it. And it just so happens that Caicedo put plus a in the top really corner. Special strike into the corner, which Mamardashvili actually got a little hand to as well. Mm. It was quite close. So look, we're not here to discuss that.
Just but on that point, quickly, I remember we did a shoot with Sky at Newcastle, and it was specifically with Dan Byrne when he was really thriving in that, you know, I think it was about February last year, and everyone went Dan Byrne crazy. Anyway, we did a shoot with him, and he was saying that that's a specific instruction from Eddie Howe as well to his centre-backs. Mm. Kind of to let people shoot unless it's in a really, really dangerous position and back your goalkeeper. And you've seen how good Newcastle's defence has been for years. So it's not anything to worry about.
Give the goalkeeper a clear line of sight on a shot, and you're just like, and don't get in the way, don't deflect it, don't block his sight. There's logic to it. Anyway, Virgil's been fine. In fact, I think there's been a couple of occasions already this season where Virgil has played like brilliantly to hold things together. Konate, on the other hand.
Wow. Really difficult. I think he started really, really badly.
Yeah.
Maybe had a better couple of games after that. And then in the last few weeks as well.
At Gala, he just like crumbled.
Yeah, wasn't good against Galatasaray. Wasn't good against Crystal Palace as well. And so many of the problems seem to be coming down that channel between him and Szoboszlai. And he just looks slightly behind the pace. He looks clumsy in possession. I mean, he's never been the most elegant player to watch, especially when he's playing alongside someone who just looks as phenomenal on the ball as Van Dijk. But every part of his game is just suffering right now. And actually, I went into his stats earlier, and it doesn't, this is where stats, particularly with centre-backs, don't tell the full story, because his tackle success rate is above 75%. He's winning the vast majority of his aerial duels. But you only have to watch Konate this season to see he's not playing anywhere near his best.
Yeah, I mean, he like basically tripped over the ball at Palace and handed it to Mateta for a one-on-one. I watched him on Saturday, just look across to his left to play quite a simple pass over to Van Dijk and just hammer it into the advertising boards for no reason. And the Galatasaray pitch looked really bad, but there were a couple that he just coughed up straight to the opposition, and everybody just sat there like, come on, Ibu, like, you're better than this. He has tended to have little patches in his Liverpool career where he does do this kind of thing, but I don't think they generally last 6 weeks, and they really need this to stop like quite quickly. And all the speculation hanging over his head with Real Madrid and the contract, it doesn't help. And when he's playing like this, this is the sort of thing where fans go, well, you know what, just get rid of him then, you know, that sort of thing. And this is where, you know, Leone's already done for the year with an ACL tear. Absolutely, like, I'm gutted for him. And they missed out on Mark Gaye in the last second. So this is where those decisions and the way those dominoes fell are starting to look like they might really, really affect Liverpool. We sat here 6 weeks ago on our return, and we were a bit concerned about the depth at centre-back for Liverpool, weren't we? And it's only taken 6 weeks for a lot of this to really come true, because they've got quite unlucky, but this is what happens in football.
Absolutely. And it is the biggest issue in the team right now is how they're defending, for me. You know, compared to this time last year at the same stage in the league, they've got one fewer win. They've scored the same amount of goals, but they've conceded seven more. And they've got three fewer points, but it could have been far more than that. They have got pretty lucky. And their XG against per game has gone from the second best to the ninth. So that is really pretty concerning. There are nine sides in the league that have conceded fewer than their nine league goals. They've kept two clean sheets in 11 games in all competitions, which was against Arsenal, which was one of the most boring games of the season, and a 1-0 win against Burnley as well.
Yeah.
And it's the quality of shot that they're conceding as well. So their post-shot XG per shot, which is a little bit of a complicated metric and sounds quite daunting, but basically the quality of shot they are conceding is at 0.37, and only United and Wolves is high in the entire league. So they are conceding very, very high quality shots, and they also rank fourth for errors leading to shots. And I think Konate has probably been more guilty of that than any other player.
Yeah, probably about half the tally, unfortunately. Well, look, sometimes they do keep clean sheets, and occasionally they play really well. Like against Atletico Madrid, I thought they absolutely destroyed Atletico Madrid, and the fact that that game was remotely close was a bit of a joke. Marcos Llorente's incredible wonder strike times two was the only reason that was in contention. And on that particular night, Ryan Gravenberch was absolutely insanely good. And when he is at a 10 out of 10 level, a lot of these defensive problems do tend to go away, because Gravenberch is so good in midfield that he can actually save everyone's jobs. Unfortunately, Ryan Gravenberch is just one human being. He's just a man. And he cannot play at a 10 out of 10 level every single time Liverpool take to the pitch. And when he doesn't, and Alexis McAllister plays like he's been playing, oh boy, this midfield looks horrific.
It feels like that Jon Snow meme. You know, one man with a sword gets an entire cavalry charge. That feels a bit like Gravenberch at the moment.
Yeah, it's a real shame. So he's been good, if not amazing. I've got not got a bad word to say about Gravenberch this season, but Alexis is confusing. Now, there were some questions about injuries and fitness issues earlier in the season. He went off to international duty and people weren't sure. He came back and people were still not sure. I mean, at the Chelsea game, he was really poor, like way off the pace. The Caicedo goal is in part because he's failed to clamp down in midfield, but all game long, he looked like all at sea. Very easy to bypass. Very low on confidence, it seems like, from a technical standpoint too. What has happened to Alexis?
Yeah, it's a difficult one, isn't it? I mean, as you'd say, there was some injury issues at the start of the season that might have knocked him a little bit. I think the change in formation, he, more than anyone, hasn't seemed like he's got the confidence to try and find Florian Wirtz in those pockets of space, which he is picking up. And last year, he was kind of, in many ways, the connector between midfield and attack and was so, so good at it. I thought along after probably Caicedo and Rice, probably the league's kind of outstanding midfielder with Ryan Gravenberch in there as well. But this year, his pass into the penalty area, which is partly down to the role he's playing as well, but they've gone from 1.2 to 0.5, which is a really quite dramatic drop off. Mm. And he hasn't completed a single one of his dribbles. His defensive actions are way down as well. It does feel like, yeah, he's probably one of the players whose role and place in the starting 11 should be most under threat, because he has played a lot of football over the last couple of seasons and maybe he just needs a little bit of a spell outside of the team.
Yeah, maybe. I'm like, if he's not quite fit, then yeah, it might be time to shuffle things about a little bit. You mentioned Wirtz there, obviously signed for 100 million plus 16, a lot of expectation, yet to register a goal or assist in the Premier League. I'm just absolutely begging for him to get one here. Like, just wanting to get off the mark, because you know what one can do for a player. And if that swivelling backheel pass to Salah at Stamford Bridge had resulted in an assist, I mean, God. Oh, Salah has become the enemy of football there by not scoring that, because he made that wasn't an assist. Just was absolutely amazing. Stepped off the bench, immediate impact, great energy, exactly what you want. But, you know, the expectations are really high for this player because he costs an absolute ton. And it hasn't really happened for him. In and out of the team, played a 10, played a bit of left wing, Slot's trying to figure out his best 11. And by the way, he's moving him in and out of the team. That means that Slot is not convinced that Florian Wirtz is yet in his best team, which is a slightly concerning place to be for a £100 million footballer, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of rival fans complaining that the media are giving him a really easy time. I don't think they are at all, to be honest. I think he's been non-stop talked about pretty much since his third or fourth game. His passes per game, I thought, was the most interesting thing. Have gone from 53 to 36. And we did talk about this on a podcast a few weeks ago with the Bundesliga attacks, that he is showing for the ball consistently. I just think he's looked a little bit slow to react, or the game is just so quick around him. And partly, it has been down to a lot of the teams they've played as well. I think Bournemouth, Newcastle, Galatasaray away, Arsenal. This is not necessarily the easiest run to start as a 10.
Sure, but mate, all the teams in the Premier League are like this now.
Sure, but this is also a squad and a team finding their feet. You've got Szoboszlai behind you that's playing in a different position. You've got McAllister out of form as well. Gravenberch has missed some games towards the start of the season. I think it's very easy to focus solely on Florian Wirtz. I'd actually be almost putting more intrigue and blame on the form of Mo Salah. And I don't mean to jump around your starting 11.
No, by all means, go to the right wing next. As I said, we haven't just put it all on Wirtz here. We've just laid into Alexis, laid into Konate, laid into Kerkez and all the right backs and slots. So yeah, we're not putting it all on him. But look, Salah, I mean, just not really involved anywhere near enough.
His dribbles per game this year are at the same as Joan Garcia, the Barcelona goalkeeper.
Nice.
0.1.
He's completed one dribble.
Yeah.
In the whole of the Premier League so far.
Really bad. His dribble success rate has gone from 42% to 13%. His shots on target have halved.
Yeah.
His shots have halved. This is a player that, yes, he's got 4 goals and assists in 7 league games, but don't be fooled by that. He is playing the worst football of his Liverpool career. And look, there can be many, many reasons behind that. We haven't really touched on in probably enough depth. Like, this is a squad that is going through huge turnover, and they're also dealing with the tragic loss of a teammate, a friend, a colleague, a massive part of a dressing room who they've played with for years. We can't actually know in physical terms what that's going to do to players and what it's going to do to a squad and the way that squad is united, etc.
And I mean, that could be a big part of, you know, Alexis and his form, you know, and his and his mental state. Virgil recently did say, he did kind of speak out on this a little bit, and he did kind of lash out at a reporter to be like, you've no idea how difficult it is on the pitch and off the pitch right now. Like, the situation is not easy. It's not simple.
There's a thing here, and I said this on Monday's Patreon on Ranks, in the at the start of the season, and I appreciate that obviously time passes and therefore, you know, different narratives emerge, and that's fine. Like, that's natural. But think about how much of the first bit of the season and Salah scoring a goal and then standing in front of the Kop, tears in his eyes, and how much that was kind of attributed to, you know, they're doing this for Diogo Jota, they're doing this for a teammate, for a friend, all of that. And then as soon as there's a bad run of form, people are like, don't know what's wrong. You're like, yeah. And then look, I do think that it's unfair to attribute everything to that. And I don't think you can, you know, at some point you have to be able to, not move on, that's the wrong phrase, but you have to be able to put it in the context of what you're doing. They're still going out there, they're still playing, and you can't blame all of it on certain or individual factors, as we're not doing with the whole team thing here. But I do think it was interesting that kind of came out of the narrative as soon as Liverpool started playing badly. Mm. When they were playing well, it was all, oh, okay, they're banding together, they're finding it. But as soon as that flipped and, you know, something went against them, that bit seemed to be forgotten. And I thought that was something just worth pointing out.
100%. Yeah, 100%. You just don't know what kind of effect this is having on the players. And it could be the case with Salah too. Just more specifically on Salah again, I've got my own stats. Well, you mentioned his shots on target have halved. Non-penalty shots this season so far, just to make it clear, 11. 11 shots. Is that it?
Yeah.
Come on, mate. Good. And all of his goals, more or less, have come in the 85th minute or later, because he can't find his way into the game before that point. You know, even on the opening game against Bournemouth, he sort of had to run over to the left wing to pick up the ball, to actually get it to go and score. So they're not finding him. Florian Wirtz is not connecting with Mohamed Salah. And Szoboszlai passes to Salah a lot when he plays right back, because he's the nearest person. But against Palace, guess how many passes Szoboszlai completed to Mohamed Salah?
Two.
Szoboszlai played as the 10 for the whole game, and Salah played as the right winger for the whole game, and Szoboszlai completed two passes to Mohamed Salah.
I also don't know about you, but when I think of a Liverpool goal from 24-25, you know, there's a lot of Salah brilliance in there for sure. But the Salah back post pass to Gakpo is something that I just can't get out of my head from last season. I just don't feel like we've seen that anywhere near to the same extent this year.
No, actually. And speaking of Gakpo, he's averaging 10 more touches per game than Salah is.
Wow.
Which, by the way, is the wrong way around. Like, it's like, that's wrong. You can't do that. Salah needs to be averaging 10 more touches than Gakpo, right? Or anyone.
Yeah.
Just about anyone, apart from, you know, the usuals, Van Dijk and Gravenberg at the centre of the team. It's not okay. But Gakpo's done his usual, you know. He's had a good patch and then he's dropped off. That's kind of what he does. He's probably been more involved than Salah because Ekitike likes to drop over to the left. He likes the left half space. So when the ball goes from probably Gravenberg straight to Ekitike, missing out Wirtz, which is bad, Ekitike drops off to his left. And then who's the closest player? Gakpo. So he brings him into the game. And so Gakpo's off and firing, and he's got loads of involvements and loads of goals. And obviously he's dropped off a bit recently, but started really well with Ekitike. And Salah's like 40 yards over on the side of the pitch with his arms in the air going, guys, anyone, guys, not involved.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think people, Liverpool fans in particular, were quite vitriolic towards Trent leaving the club. Obviously, it's incredibly painful. He'd made noises that he wanted to stay at the club forever, caption the club, etc. Left to go to Real Madrid, was speaking pretty perfect Spanish in his press conference. I can understand why they were frustrated. But I think his impact in that side is now fully being seen.
Yes, I would agree with that one.
The way that not only he can connect with Salah, and those connections are vital. We've seen over the last even 2 years, since Urien Timber has come into the Arsenal side, that White Odegaard Saka arrangement on that right hand side pretty much put Arsenal into title contention. Timber, Odegaard, Saka, and there has been injury issues in there as well, hasn't flowed as naturally. Trent, Henderson and Salah played together for years and did so incredibly effectively. Trent, even the way he could flick a ball almost around his marker in to find Szoboszlai or Gravenberch or McAllister, I think they're being marked out of the game way too easily, sort of Liverpool's midfielders, and it's kind of affecting the flow through to Vert and flow to the forward line. I mean, Trent last year wasn't even necessarily his best season, but he was fifth for passes completed in the Liverpool squad last year. He was second for assists, fourth for chances created, crucially, second for passes into the final third. And Liverpool don't seem to be able to get into the final third as quickly and as efficiently as they could last year. And it feels like the sides and that they're facing are just way more set defensively. And I think a big part of that is Trent's, lack of presence in the side.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very different. I think we're still discovering, but week on week we're realizing more and more how big a loss it actually is, because it's not just a right back, is it? I said it earlier in the pod, one of the most talented passers of the ball the world has ever seen, and you've taken him out of the team and then remodeled the entire thing. And as good as Florian Wirtz is, like, obviously the idea is for him to come in and become the fulcrum and the playmaker there, changes and moves up the pitch, but it needs more than 6 to 8 weeks for that to really settle in.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to bring this up. It's something we've talked about a little bit, but point of attack, right? Like, as you say, creative fulcrum, lightning rod, whatever you want to call it. That's what Wirtz has been brought in to do. Mm. Right? But you're shifting your point of attack from a right back who tucks inside and picks the ball up deep to someone who wants to collect the ball far higher up the pitch and get into the final third. And I think the knock-on effect from this has been something that you haven't mentioned, which I think is probably important here, is how slow Liverpool are playing the ball out the back. And part of this is Virgil van Dijk, who stands on the ball a lot. Now, this isn't necessarily a bad thing, but actually what we're seeing is a lot of very safe possession, and then Liverpool look for kind of a punt up the field, which isn't what they were doing last season. And last season, they would look for Trent quite early on, get him onto the ball in those areas, and he'd be able to pick that pass to put Liverpool in dangerous situations.
Probably the Diaz switch as well.
Yeah, exactly. Whether that's down the line to Salah, whether it's the switch across to Diaz, or even whether it's into Szoboszlai in that kind of number 10 spot, you had someone who was able to pick those range of passes. And it also meant that Liverpool moved the ball up the pitch pretty quickly. Now, the other option was having Gravenberch kind of turn out of pressure and drive up the pitch. It feels at times that that's Liverpool's only way this season of moving the ball up into the final thirds. And they're really struggling to connect to their new point of attack, in that Florian Wirtz isn't picking up the ball in the areas that he wants to pick it up. Now, by my standards, I think he should have had... I worked it out the other day. I was looking at them. I think he should have had 4 assists, 3 of them for Salah this season already, if you're kind of looking at players who should be putting away their chances. Yeah. And, some of that is his fault, some of it's not, like, et cetera, et cetera. These things happen. But I do think that Liverpool's main issue is they're not being able to move that creative fulcrum to the new point in their squad with any success in terms of how they're building out. And that, I think, is the question that Arne Slot needs to answer in this international break: how they get the ball into those areas without completely and utterly throwing their structure up in the air, which is what they have done for quite a lot of the first sort of 8-10 games of this season.
You lead us on quite nicely to the next part of the conversation, which is, like, what do you do next? Like, how do you fix this? And you're kind of focusing there on how to bring the attack back into function and how to get the new setup with the new playmaker going. I focused mostly on how do you fix the big hole in midfield? Because I think that might be an even bigger problem. The fact that you reeled off all the statistics earlier about giving up very high quality chances, and then you watch them and, like, how open have they been? Like, an injury hit undercooked Bournemouth gave them a massive, massive scare with Marcus Tavernier in midfield on the opening night. And I thought, whew, they got away with that. It'll be fine next week. And then they had another scare and another scare. And then the losses started coming in. And, like, those last 15 minutes against Chelsea, once you get the ball past Liverpool's front line and past Gravenberch, it's like an ocean of space. And Van Dijk and Konate are pegging it backwards. It was just remarkable watching the Chelsea midfielders run into that. Like, it's way too open structurally. And it's not normal. It's not what Liverpool were last season. I feel like Slot is caught in the middle of some kind of very strange tactical dance with himself. He's really undecided as to what he wants this team to be and whether or not it can work. And from the very start there, I'll say, like, the idea that you can have Kerkez and Frimpong left and right back shuttling up and down the flanks as both of them means that you have to make a sacrifice in midfield.
Yeah, you have to have two. You have to have two holding midfielders. There's no other way around it.
And you have to have Gravenberch probably dropping into the defensive line to make a three to solidify it. If you're going to do that, and possibly as well Alexis. Now he's not really tried that because he's pushed Kerkez into left centre back and built with a three, which also hasn't worked. And then Frimpong's got injured, so that hasn't worked either. So whatever he's tried there hasn't worked. And then in midfield, I mean, if Gravenberch is breached, Gravenbreach.
Splashy.
They are so screwed. It's just bizarre. It's absolutely bizarre. So I don't know. Like, I feel like they're trying to attack in this like 4-2-4 at the moment. And it's like, it's not good enough. It doesn't work. And Slot is going to have to tweak it. And he's going to have to take a player out of the attack. And he's going to have to plonk him in the middle. Because if they don't stem the tide of these counterattacks, like I said to you, all the Premier League teams are built like this. It's all Bournemouth. It's Fulham running through. It's all these teams can do this. They've all got athletic midfielders that can take the ball and just go. Like, what does Morgan Rogers do when he sees 40 yards of space? You know, it's got to be fixed before anything else, I think.
I've got four ideas on how to fix
four?
It. And they are more, they ascend in drama.
Oh, good.
Do you want to hear them at the, this is the least dramatic.
Go 4-1.
Okay, 4-1 is just, number four was just revert back. Szoboszlai, McAllister, Gravenberch, which is what he tried to do against Chelsea. Bradley gets subbed at halftime for Florian Wirtz and, you know, persist with that. It's what you knew last season. Go back to that. The second idea, if you're lacking control in midfield, the midfielder that is best at controlling a game, not necessarily the most entertaining at points, but the best controller is Curtis Jones. Curtis Jones is phenomenal at keeping hold of the ball.
That's true.
He is fourth in the Premier League for pass completion last season in terms of the percentage and first amongst midfielders. A 93% completion rate on his passes. That is European right up there. Right up there. That's probably Pedri levels, and Pedri gets through far, far more passes per game. So that'd be my second idea. Maybe Curtis Jones is introduced, Szoboszlai is fixed at right back. The third idea, almost losing track of the amount of ideas I've got.
In at number two,
in terms of drama, is drop Ibrahima Konate and give Joe Gomez a run at centre-back.
Okay.
I don't think Arne Slot really rates Joe Gomez.
Well, definitely doesn't. Look, he would have used him by now.
Yeah.
But I'm stunned that Gomez hasn't been given a proper look at this point.
It feels really harsh. He's only ever started 6 league games for Arne Slot. And his injury record in the last couple of years hasn't actually been that bad. He's just not being picked anymore. And he's playing Gravenberch there. He's even played Endo there. I'm not entirely sure why. This one doesn't feel very likely for Slot. But surely, you know, this is a guy that's in 2019-20 was an absolutely crucial part. And admittedly, that was a long amount of time ago now.
This is like when someone the other day asked me, like, do you think Dominic Calvert-Lewin can get back to his best scoring levels? And I was like, remind me what year that was? 2017?
I just think, and it's a shame that Leone did his ACL, because actually in the game that he did his ACL, he was looking pretty exceptional, admittedly against quite inferior opposition. But still, real shame. Maybe they could have played either Gomez or Leone. It doesn't feel particularly likely, but Konate not playing well at the moment. The most dramatic idea...
If you say drop Salah, I'm going to walk out the studio.
No. Okay. Is switch formation quite dramatically. You have signed a phenomenal right wing back. You have signed Florian Wirtz, who thrived in that system as well, a 3-4-3 formation.
Here we go.
Could it be worth trying?
Yeah.
And I will read you off the 11 that I've settled on. Alisson in goal, if he's fully fit.
Yeah.
Right wing back, Frimpong.
Frimpong.
And next to him, Konate. Van Dijk in the middle, Joe Gomez, or potentially even Andy Robertson as a left-sided centre-back,
yep.
Where he has played.
That's where
for Scotland.
And also in Liverpool's build-up, that's exactly where he stands.
Kerkez as a flying left wing back. Sounds quite nice. In midfield, Gravenberch and for now Szoboszlai. Could be McAllister, but Gravenberch and Szoboszlai. Up front as an inverted right forward, Mo Salah, inverted left forward, Florian Wirtz, and then you can either play Ekitike or Isak in the middle. Do we think this is potentially worth trying for Liverpool right now when they have so little control and haven't looked particularly good in any facet of the game? It's radical.
It's not that radical, because they'll at times resemble a 3-4-3 when they end up building. So
My issue is they don't really have the centre-backs for it. But
well, they kind of do. They just don't have any depth.
My solution wasn't drastically different for yours, although it doesn't go to a three at the back. It was play a Connor Bradley at right back and kind of tuck him in a little bit more. And then you play the back two, which they can't really sort of change from right now because that's what they've got. And Slot, as you say, doesn't really trust Gomez. And then you go, Kirke's at left back, but you push him forward and you say, go on and get up the pitch. Play Florian Wirtz at left wing, but ask him to come inside into that pocket. It doesn't really matter who you play as the nine here, whether it's Ekitike or Izak, doesn't hugely matter. I think the Salah should be dropped at the moment, but I don't think that they will. And it's a point I want, and a question I want to ask you both in a minute. But I think Salah stays in there. And then you play Curtis Jones and Gravenberch as the kind of base of midfield with Szoboszlai and that energy in front of them again. I think that sorts out some of the issues in terms of the big hole in midfield. I think it sorts out some of the issues in terms of the way that it's tilting at the back. And it puts Florian Wirtz into a position where, yes, normally he starts on the left wing, but he drifts inside into that area.
He's playing instead of Salah.
No. The Salah starts. But honest, if it was me, I'd start Chiesa. Like, I think that he's shown more hunger, more desire, and has been more energetic in all of his performances. But I don't think Slot will do that. So that's kind of, it's a kind of moot point.
It's definitely creating a rod for your own back there. Like, in a difficult situation, how do I make this worse? Drop Mo Salah is like the number one way to dig that hole a bit deeper.
But he's been dreadful.
No, I'm completely with you. But, you know, from a political standpoint, it's just like, it's an absolute no right now.
Can you name a game that Mo Salah's played well in since he renewed his contract?
No, I can't. No. I genuinely can't. I'm just going to go and look at the games he's played recently. Because
did he play all right against Atletico Madrid? I was actually watching the other game.
It wasn't a Salah game. You know, the game against Chelsea at the weekend, where there were so many opportunities for Salah to do what Salah does.
Yeah.
Like, it was a game state,
yes,
that was actually primed for Mo Salah to take advantage of. And it just felt like he was a million miles off it. It was bizarre.
He cut in to shoot and whip one round into the far post three times and missed them all. And I was just like, just not used to seeing it. Just really not used to. Then again, I'm not used to seeing Alexis McAllister just like run over in midfield. I'm not used to watching Ibrahima Konate smash the ball out of play for no reason. There's a lot of spooky stuff going on at Liverpool right now. They're all afflicted and they've got to come through it together. It's very difficult. I like the 3-4-3 pitch. As long as you've got someone somewhere from one of the other lines moving into midfield, because, you know, criticise them for having a bit of an open midfield and you've only got two players in there. But that, you know, you can have Robertson pushing up in, or you can have Wirtz dropping in from the other side. That can easily happen to create a three. It's the kind of shake-up that I would like to see. But I don't know how far Slot would go with it.
Well, otherwise it just feels like they haven't bought the right fullbacks for a four at the back necessarily. And look, you can change it. It's very early to write off Jeremy Frimpong in terms of his Premier League longevity. But at the moment, speaking to Liverpool fans that I know, they are really, really unimpressed with how he's played. And he actually started at right wing against Galatasaray. And it was really kind of, talking about spooky, it was really weird seeing a right winger get to the byline for Liverpool and then cut it back. He didn't actually play too badly for the first 30 minutes of that game. But yeah, they need to get him in somehow, because this is a real attacking weapon when played in his correct position. And I think he could be a bit of a game changer in the Premier League, as poor as he's been so far.
Yeah, absolutely.
A question for you both. So something that's been brought up to us by a number of our patrons on Ranks has been Slot's stubbornness, shall we say. And when he dropped, and we mentioned it earlier, Jarrod Kwanzaa at halftime in that first game against Ipswich last season, he was like, oh, Arne Slot, no nonsense, ruthless with his decisions. And to an extent, that was true. But it was quite easy to drop a Jarrod Kwanzaa, I imagine. It's not the same. And this season, when we've seen his favourites, shall we say, in inverted commas, your Konates, your Salahs, your Alexises, have poor performances, there has been no real sign of it. Hakpo and Salah both got 90 minutes against Chelsea, which was inexplicable considering the way that Salah played in that game. And I do wonder if he is a little bit stuck here with, you know, the players that he's relied on last season.
That he overplayed last season, by the way, as well. This plays into this.
Yeah, yeah.
How many times were we like, give Gravenberch a rest?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Do you remember the games between, they played two games against PSG, obviously in the knockouts, the Wednesday and the Tuesday. And in between, they had a game at home to Southampton, the worst team in the league. And he played like nine of his starters. And we were all just like, mate.
Well, he barely rotated at all.
What are you doing? Like, why have you played all of these players in this game?
Surprise, come April, May, they looked really poor. And
Gravenberch was dribbling the ball out of play and huffing and puffing because he was knackered.
Yeah.
Slot doesn't doesn't rotate these players.
But the key point here is that, you know, when that kind of narrative that he was this ruthless manager who was willing to drop players and it was a full meritocracy is no longer standing up. And I wonder if there needs to be an element of a reshuffle from his perspective in order to actually start to get this to work. To your point about fullbacks, Diggy, like, what I would do if I was Liverpool is, well, I'd play Frimpong when Robertson was on the other flank. Mm-hmm. I'd play Kerkez when Bradley was on the other flank. Like, there are ways around this if you think them through. Mm-hmm. But to play them together leaves you exposed in all sorts of manners. And that's how it is.
It does, yeah. Someone's having a bad time if they play together. Either the midfielders, because both the fullbacks have gone forward, or one of the fullbacks because one of them has to tuck in and they're not happy doing it because it's not their position.
It would be nice to mention a positive because it has been, you know, well, quite negative.
We've done a few positives.
Yeah, no, for sure. But I think Ekitike, really impressive. Really impressive, especially given it must have been challenging in the summer. You know, you've just got your big move to Liverpool. You're, you know, a well-deserved Premier League player now. You're joining the Premier League champions. And then as soon as you join, there is so much noise about Alexander Isak coming in. And he does eventually join for a Premier League record fee. What does that mean for you? People saying you're going to play out on the left, which, you know, he could potentially but I don't think it's the most natural move for him. But despite that, despite all the noise going on around him and about him being replaced from the get-go, from the first minute of the Community Shield, he's looked bang at it. And we've talked so many times about Bundesliga forwards taking a while to adapt, sometimes never adapting. Ekitike, 5 goals and 1 assist in 10 games in a challenging side that haven't really found their groove in any facet, as we've already mentioned. Fair play.
Great red card too.
Great red card.
He's been fantastic. We glossed over it because, yeah, it's not, oh, it's not part of the narrative that we're forming. The evil media. No, you're right. You're absolutely right to pull him up. I kind of, we got to Salah and Gakpo and then we sort of left the 11, but there was one man remaining and it is the fantastic Hugo Ekitike. His link-up play has been superb. His hold-up play has been superb. The way he brings his midfielders into the game, links with the wingers, turns, moves, goes. He's already scored a couple of lovely goals. Like, there was the goal that he scored at the end of last season against Spurs, where he ran and then drifted inwards and then, like, in step, low, beautiful strike. I thought, wish I could strike a ball like that. He's already done about 2 more that I think, I just wish I could score that goal. He scores goals that I dream of. He really does. He's brilliant. So well done to him. You're right. Absolutely well done. And, you know, to an extent, his brilliance has kind of kept them afloat a little bit because they've won a bunch of games this year that we've all gone at. And if it isn't for players doing the business when it matters, and, you know, whether that's last gasp goals from Salah or Rio, or if it's just someone like Ekitike stepping up and providing a moment of clarity, the wins don't stack up, undeservedly so, unless players like Ekitike hit the ground running and just get it done. And so he's been a genuine saving grace for them early this season, because if he hadn't started well, they'd have half the wins. And this wouldn't be a question, this would be an actual crisis, because they'd have about 6 points and they'd be playing terribly after a £400 million gross spend, and we'd be going mad.
Well, exactly. And also, on sort of slot, he seems like an obvious point. He has bought himself so much time by winning the title in your first year when no one expected you to, with you being up against it, having not had so much investment in your squad. And look, other factors have to come into that. Arsenal had big injuries, but they also were off it last year. City didn't have Rodri, pretty much fell apart by City standards. But yet you win your title in your first season, becoming just the 5th Premier League manager to do so. And the noise on social media, about from some Liverpool fans with that should know better, I think has gone a step too far at the moment. And they are, despite their level of performance, in a brilliant position. 1 point behind Arsenal after 7 games is really not a disaster. Yep. And yes, losing 3 games in a row, 2 of those were in very dramatic fashion. They could have easily drawn against Palace. They could have easily drawn against Chelsea. I actually thought they were really flat, particularly in the second half against Galatasaray. But it's really not a disaster. So despite the sort of questions and ideas about how to fix them in this podcast, you know, the context of that has to be taken into account, which I think we both have.
Sure, but they lost to Palace and then Palace lost to Everton. So that makes Liverpool worse than Everton. That's how results work.
That's how it happens. Yeah,
yeah, that's why the panic. Right, so to sum up, Salah is not involved and playing poorly. Wirtz is struggling to put a stamp on the team. If Gravenberch doesn't play brilliantly, the whole thing collapses. Konate's had a mind melt. Kerkez is being asked to stuff he literally cannot do for some reason. None of the right backs are working, and it turns out Trent was really good.
Yeah.
Is that it? Oh, and Slot's overwhelmed.
And maybe switch to a five. Mix it up,
maybe,
man.
Maybe switch to a five. Okay. Well, that is a full discussion on the troubles and travails of Liverpool.
It was.
A full discussion. Thank you, Doogie.
Thank you, Sam.
Thank you, Jack.
Thank you, Sam. I do think Doogie's point there is important. Like, with all of this said, I trust that Slot works this out. I don't know if it's any of the things that we've suggested or this team finally click or whatever, but they are, as Doogie says, a point behind in terms of the Premier League. And you said right at the top of this podcast, you made a point, you said you don't play your best football in October.
Hell yeah.
You play it, you know, you play it when it comes to the start of the new year, when it comes to the run-in. And I trust Liverpool to have worked it out by that point. And by that logic, if they continue to not play brilliantly, but hang in there and hang in there and hang in there, then I think that this could still be one of those seasons where Liverpool will be there or thereabouts. And, you know, whether that's winning the league, whether they get pipped to it, you know, whatever that looks like is a question. But on the whole, I trust that they will be no lower than second when it comes to the final standings of this Premier League table in May.
There you go. A nice positive spin to end. Look at how many points they've already accrued, and they've been useless. Now imagine what they'll be like when they're good. That's a good one.
Exactly.
I like it. Thank you very much, Jack. And thank you, finally, to the listeners. Thanks for joining us, and thanks for watching as well. If you're on YouTube, I guess, head over to Doogie's YouTube channel if you want to watch and listen to the podcast twice, which we all expect you to do.
Double up.
Absolutely. And we'll see you next week.
See you then.